This program is copyright 1991 by National Vanguard Books. Post Office Box 330, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. All rights reserved. The speech you're about to hear was delivered by Emory Burke at the General Convention of the National Alliance held over the 1982 Labor Day weekend in Chicago, Illinois. In many ways, Emory Burke is a bridge between the generations, a man whose struggle encompasses the racial awakening that took place in America during the 1920s and 1930s, the time of Lothrop Stoddart, Madison Grant, William Dudley Pelley, and Henry Ford Sr., and who is still active today in the movement for a new consciousness among the white peoples of the world. A son of the South, Mr. Burke was born into a society and a family that were both very conscious of racial matters. But imbued with a spiritual urge to learn as much as he could, he went farther than most of his fellows, and by the age of 15 was voraciously reading Grant, Stoddart, Houston Stuart Chamberlain, Gobineau, and other prominent writers on the racial question. In the 1930s, he worked in Pelley's Silver Shirts, later becoming a nationwide speaker for a pro-white group calling itself the American National Labor Party. For the latter group, Mr. Burke made a speech in 1940 that was widely circulated, even in Europe, where it was read and approved by some of the more progressive leaders of that time. With the defeat of the European forces in 1945, it was up to men like Mr. Burke to keep our ideas alive in a hostile world. This he did, in 1946 founding an organization called the Columbians, which within a year had a solid base of support in Georgia, primarily in the Atlanta area, where between 3 and 5,000 citizens were unafraid to display the Thunderbolt, symbol of the organization. Anti-American forces, some of them within the government, were determined to stamp out this manifestation of Western man's will to live, and accordingly, perjurers and infiltrators were dispatched. And Emory Burke one day read in the newspapers that his organization was stockpiling dynamite and other weapons in preparation for a takeover of the government. This was news to him, but in post-World War II America, truth is often no defense, and Mr. Burke was imprisoned for 16 months. Many lesser men would have been intimidated and retired from the field of racial struggle. But Emory Burke has continued the fight for his people right up to the present day. For example, in 1987, at the age of 72, he published a book of racially inspiring poetry, The Will of the West. And he is now working on an historical novel dealing with the tragic error of importing blacks into North America. Let's listen now as he tells his own story.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, fellow members of the National Alliance, it's a great honor to me today to be with you and to recount a few experiences that I've had down through the years, going back roughly 50 years. Well, to begin with, I had the good fortune of growing up in my young years in an environment of people who basically believed in maintaining the purity of their blood, including my family, and all of my teachers in grammar school and high school were actually intense racists for the time. They were literate people, and they'd read, Gobineau, for instance. One of my teachers referred to me. He said, Emory, go to the library and get out Arthur Gobineau's Inequality of Human Races. And I did, and that's one of the first books on race that I ever read. And then, of course, later on, in the meantime, they were reading Stoddart and the rest of the great writers of our race who have put our feelings and our philosophy into words. I read all of those. So when I was first introduced to National Socialism, it came as something very natural, and I couldn't understand why everybody in the South and throughout all the North of that time was so bitterly opposed to what Adolf Hitler was saying over in Germany. Because at least among the Southern people, at least on the Negro question, his ideas are right in harmony with all Southerners, certainly. Of course, they weren't at all, they knew nothing about the Jewish question to speak of. But at least on the Negro question, they certainly knew that their way of life demanded that they never, under any circumstances, think in terms of mixing the genes that had been handed down by thousands of generations of the white race to mix those genes with blacks. It was something that was unheard of, and no one would even dream of even thinking of the subject. So it was in that basic environment that I grew up in. Race to me was, even then, I might say religion. It was actually my religion. And then, about the early part of 33, after Hitler had taken over in Germany, I read a little small ad in the local paper. It says, the leader of my country is being talked about as if he's a monster today, but if people want to really know the truth about him, come to my office, and I'll enlighten you. And the little ad in the paper was signed Hans Kippenberg. So I was delighted to take him up. So I went. He was a cotton broker in Montgomery at the time. He was over here buying cotton for Germany. So I was delighted to go to his office. And he brings out a little book, a small version of Mein Kampf. To my knowledge, it was the first English translation of Mein Kampf. And a beautiful job, because it dealt mainly with the basic philosophical ideas of National Socialism. It didn't go into a lot of history of Hitler's experience in Vienna and that sort of thing, which really wasn't particularly relevant to Americans. And I was just delighted with that book, man. I just read it as a sort of a Bible. I said, I didn't know such a man lived. These ideas I believe in. And so from then on out, I was confirmed in the basic racial principles that has been my religion since. And Kippenberg gave me the names of quite a few people. Well, among them, William Dudley Pelley, who was putting out a publication at that time called Liberation. And, of course, I subscribed to it. And then when I became 18 years old, the August of that year, I joined the Silver Shirts. And then, in the meantime, I was corresponding with quite a number of individuals in New York. Now, most of these individuals that I was working with at the time, the greater part of them, I'd say, were born in Germany, but they'd come to America and become American citizens. And, of course, I was after an organization that preached the race idea with a strong American coding. And all of these German Americans in New York, they were mainly members of the Friends of New Germany organization. And they were American citizens, and they wanted more of an American organization, too, rather than just an organization devoted to being friendly with the Third Reich. So finally, it was a thousand or two of them, or maybe more, they pull away from the Friends of New Germany and form an organization called the National Socialist League. And I would say this was in the early part of 35. But it still wasn't an organization that I felt like that I could throw my whole soul and being into, because I couldn't see using the term National Socialism, because socialism in the first place doesn't mean to the average American what it means to the German. Socialism to the German means more like social justice, social in the sense of social security and that sort of thing. But to the American, it means Marxism, really. The average American, he doesn't make much of a distinction between socialism and Marxism. They're just about the same. So I just insisted that I didn't see how we could very well use the word National Socialism and use the swastika as a symbol. And I don't think that my feelings necessarily did it, but anyway, along about September of 33, They changed the name of the organization to the American National Labor Party and became what? Just an out-and-out American party. And the National American was a tabloid they published every month. Well, let's see. And then years went on. That was 36. In the meantime, April of that year, I'd married. And you know, when you're in this movement, in a way, we all are two people. But there's a part of us that has to devote itself to a wife and family and the ordinary affairs that govern all of us, whoever we are. And that other part of us is dedicated to the higher interests of the race. And in a way, there's always a struggle going on there of which should we follow, the motions of the home and the hearth, of the thunderings of the duty to our race. So, but anyway, my wife, luckily I might say, has always stood by me through all the storms that we both have endured. There's never been any, she's not necessarily particularly as engrossed or deeply involved as I've always been, but she's been a loyal wife and has stood by me in every way. So then, the war comes on, of course, in 41. And now my attitude toward the war is simply this. I took the attitude that if I were drafted, and I was up to be drafted three times, passed the examination three times, and would have been drafted to go to the Pacific. And but I had already made up my mind if they had asked me to go and fight our brothers and sisters in Germany, that I was going to refuse on conscientious grounds, that I considered it a crime and a sin to fight our own racial brothers. And I very definitely would have done it. But each time I was deferred, because during part of the time I was in the engineering department of the Western Railroad that ran between Montgomery and Atlanta, and they deferred me to be involved in the work to keep the trains running. And then during part of the time I was in Marietta, and the only reason I was up there in the Bell aircraft place is because we were making the B-29, and it was only used against Japan, because I would not have worked in a factory making planes to bomb Germany. And of course every day I was here at Lord Hall, a short way from Germany, who is one of our heroes. And in a happier day, we'll see a monument dedicated to him, I'm sure, many monuments. But anyway, the years went on by, and the war was over. Let's see, I might say right now that I'm planning to spend about half of my time telling about my past, and then the other half, I would like to discuss with you what has kept me going, what has inspired me enough to, whatever happens to keep going, and not to give up hope. So I'll speak just a few more minutes on my experiences. Well, anyway, the war finally came to an end, and of course it was agony to know that the one real chance that our race had of redeeming itself and finding salvation, that it was turned down, distorted. And I just said, well, somebody's got to do something. And at that particular time, there was just nothing going on. So a few friends of mine and myself, we said, well, we'll get something started. So we get together and we start holding meetings, speaking race, of course, because that's all really that's important. Because if we are right racially, we don't have to worry about economics and the right kind of banking system and all that stuff, the abolition of interest, because that'll be done just naturally. If we get our racial home in order, those things will work themselves out naturally. So I've always felt like we don't have to give a lot of thought to economics. If we have our people thinking the right racial thoughts, all of that will come just as natural as a farmer knowing how to plant seed. But anyway, we formed this organization. We first started, we were really in love with the idea of Columbia because it's the poetical name of America. And it sprang to life back at a beautiful time of America, at a time when we all considered ourselves Americans. We didn't consider ourselves Southerners or Northerners, and before the great schism came that divided us, and we fought that monstrous war that never should have been fought, wouldn't have been fought if we'd had the right kind of statesmanship here in America at the time, both North and South. But anyway, we got together as a band of brothers and sang Hail Columbia, Happy Land, and it grew. The first meeting we held was on my 31st birthday, August 26, 46, in the courthouse of East Point, Georgia, right out of Atlanta. And then we started holding open-air meetings. And believe it or not, the people just started coming in droves. And we got a sound truck and went through the neighborhoods advertising the meeting, where it was going to be at the corner, such and such corner. And each meeting was bigger than the other one. And finally, in September of that year, we had a meeting that, oh heavens, well even the press said it was about 3,500 or 4,000, as I recall at this meeting, and that was more enthusiastic. The people were just clapping and shouting and approval. It was just a glorious experience. And I told all the men after the meeting that night, I said, well now, up until then, they'd have totally ignored us, as if we didn't even exist. Nothing ever in the newspapers about us, and we were holding bigger meetings than the regular politicians at that time were holding, because it was elections going on at the time, that fall. But anyway, after this meeting, I said, now, we're going to hear from this. And sure enough, the next morning, the Atlanta Constitution, Ralph McGill, Scalawag editor of the Constitution, he acknowledges that we are on the scene with something like, today it's a little small cloud of storm gathering in the distance, but if something is not stopped, it will be a storm that will engulf us all, or something along that line, sort of poetic as much as they can make poetry. We kept holding meetings. We had a hall, of course, where we held small meetings. And during that time, we were attacked by a bunch of Jews one night, Jewish war veterans, they claimed to be. I don't know what they were. They probably were an early version of the Jewish Defense League, because they threw tear gas all over the place, and filled it up with tear gas, but it didn't break up the meeting. I said, folks, go out and get your breath of come out of air. We're not going to let them break us up. Didn't come back to the hall, and they did. But it was that sort of nuisance thing which really didn't bother us. Open-air meetings, they didn't do that. And they threw those tear gas bombs in through the windows. But anyway, in November, they really started. Well, no, it was earlier than November. I'd say in October. Now, I'm going to say some things that I hope all of you believe, because with every ounce of my being, what I say is true. But I know that probably some of you won't believe it. But they were so anxious to get rid of us and stop us that they prosecuted. And I have this in the form of affidavits written by the two boys that I'm talking about now. They succeeded in getting two of our members to go along with them, because they actually just scared them to death. Says, if you stay in with these Colombians, you're going to be behind bars the rest of your life. And they scared two of our members so that they joined up with them. And they went before the grand jury and all that sort of stuff. But anyway, before then, the prosecutor gave them money, unrolled the green stuff, gave it to them to go out and buy dynamite. And they went out and bought the dynamite, enough to fill up practically that table there with the sticks of dynamite, with money furnished by the prosecutor. He goes before the grand jury and indicts us for possession of dynamite, for possessing that very dynamite that he had bought that we had never seen. As a matter of fact, at the time it was done, I was in Montgomery, Alabama, visiting my mother, who was quite ill at the time. I was in Montgomery, and I didn't know any more about it taking place, the purchase of the dynamite, than any of you knew about it. But that afternoon in the Atlanta Journal was great big headlines that high in letters, Dynamite of Colombians found. And there was a picture of the dynamite, see. And of course, with that, he goes before the grand jury, and we indicted for possession of dynamite. And there were several Negro homes that had been dynamited. We didn't have anything to do with it, but we weren't exactly accused of it in the indictment, but the indictment was written in such a way that it's pretty obvious that they've been dynamiting Negro homes. But anyway, we were indicted, and then after Christmas, we were tried. The trial was about 4 days, and I was really the only one that ever served any time to amount to anything. The secretary of the organization, he was tried too and convicted the same length of time I was, from 3 to 4.5 years. I mean, the theory is that if you're good, it's each indictment count was a year, but if you're bad, of course, and don't behave yourself, it's a year and a half, so that would have been 4.5 years instead of 3. Well, anyway, I was indicted, and then there was a period in there of several years where I was appealing the thing, at least trying to get a new trial, and in the meantime, these two boys that had lied against us, they couldn't sleep at night. And finally, they come forward and say, we've got to sign an affidavit saying what we have done, because we've lied, and out of fear, we said all of these things. So I drew up a special extraordinary motion on the basis of their testimony, on the basis of their affidavits, and that went all the way to the Supreme Court, after I'd already gone to the Georgia Supreme Court twice. And when it got up to the Supreme Court, they said we hadn't exhausted all state remedies, which of course we had, because we'd gone to the Supreme Court twice, and that's all you could do. It was the end of it. But anyway, I was indicted, sent off to prison. They had the pleasure of handcuffing me to a Negro murderer who had killed 4 or 5 of his own kind, including his mother-in-law and a brother-in-law. And they handcuffed me to the Negro to send me down to Reedsville from the tower in Atlanta. And I was there for 16 months. And, well, there's just a lot that I can tell about in from there. I spent the summer of 49 in California holding meetings out there with Gerald Smith. I'm sure all of you have heard of Gerald Smith. And not that I was always pleased with it, because a lot of things were said that I didn't approve of, but he was the only one that offered me any kind of help at all. And by then I had 4 children and a wife, and I didn't compromise any of my principles in being with him. But anyway, let's see, I'm about to run out of time here. So I will just let that rest as to my experiences. There's so much that I could talk about. I did know Lincoln Rockwell. I was up here, I attended his funeral. And I had the pleasure of knowing him way back in 57. I met him in 57 before he'd ever gone to Arlington. And there's so much I'd like to talk about. But for the time being, I'll just let that go. But now, what's left to me, about 15 minutes or so, I want to try to tell all of you what's kept me going. And let me go back a little to form a little foundation to what I have to say. Way back years ago, the thing that has motivated me is that here we are, the descendants of the highest form of life on this earth, that nature, after hundreds of thousands of years has created. We are the heirs of that form of life. And if it is sustained, and if it survives, not only survives, but if it lives to go even upward, it's upon us, not just our kin, but upon us who believe as we believe to see that that's done. Now, a lot of times we think in terms of our people as being cut up into all sorts of nationalities. Little cliques here and cliques there, and little geographical areas here and there. But the fact of the matter is, we are all really one race. Originally, probably one tribe, way back at the time of the, in the wake of the Ice Age. Because I firmly believe, and I think the character of our race itself confirms it, that we had to have evolved and been created in a most fearsome environment, as I see it. And out of say 10 children born, there probably wasn't but one survived. Well, if you carry on selection like that over a period of thousands of years, because we're speaking of thousands of years, the Ice Ages, that nature had to have created a superior race. There's no getting around it. The selective process that created us is what has created us as the superior race. And I don't hesitate to say, so far as I'm concerned, I'm tired of making apologies to these that stand up for false values and simply plain lies, because we're the ones that represent the truth. It's not the other side. So many of them look at us, oh, but you don't believe in God, you don't believe in religion, and you are heathens. Well, in a way, I guess every word they say is true with their values. But the God that we believe in is in the God that lives in the workings out of nature herself. But that is the true and living God. The gods that they worship are idols. And not only that, those idol gods teach them lies to teach. But the feelings that we have, the knowledge that we have, is based on truth. There isn't any lies about what we believe. It's true. It can be proven empirically true. And the glory of it is that it's only in this last 100 years, you might say since the time of Charles Darwin, that we have had the knowledge really to be able to build a new conception of society and the world and of life, because we didn't have the knowledge. 100 years ago, we barely knew that water's 2 parts hydrogen and 1 part oxygen. It's recent knowledge. And in a sense, I like to think in these terms here, that this whole fight, this whole struggle that we are involved in, can be reduced down to the simple equation of the lies of the old man on one side. And I mean by the old man, the old ideas that are no longer valid, against the truths of the new man. And we are the new man, because we have the truth. And really, and to me that's so simple. There are those that seem to make such a complex thing of it. It's so simple. It's a simple, basic thing, so simple that every farmer that keeps weeds out of his garden knows the validity of the principle involved. And it seems to me like that just common sense, just the instinct that the average man has would go along with everything we believe in race. It's so simple. I can't see how anybody cannot believe it, really. But anyway, and those who hold these ideas, they are the ones that will determine whether we have a future or not. And so far as I'm concerned, this age in which we live is the most important, the most awesome, the most terrible age that we have lived in since our ancestors were struggling with the environment that created them back there 20 and 25,000 years ago. Because today, if this battle is not won, we don't have any more future than the diseased, ignorant, the black things in the darkest jungles of Africa. We don't have any more future than they have. Maybe not as much. Maybe not as much. And another thought that I want to really emphasize is this. In the darkest hour, whatever happens, know this, that no force on this earth can destroy.